Welcome to Lecture 39, The Ultimate Free Lunch. In the previous lecture, we began our discussion of the inflationary theory of the universe, a modification to the standard Big Bang theory that, as you will see, appears to get rid of some of the Big Bang theory's most flagrant problems. This is complicated stuff. This is the most complex part of the course. It's conceptually rather difficult. Just get the qualitative idea. If you understand the math, that's great. But just get the essence of the idea I'm trying to bring across. And I will reinforce it and extend it in this lecture. The standard Big Bang has this problem that if you extrapolate the current observed radius of the universe backwards in time, it was always too large compared to the distance over which light or anything else could have traveled. So there was no way for it to come into equilibrium to the same temperature, for example. Now you might say that, well, gee, the Big Bang started with a point, that was the idea, or at least infinite density, so how can I say that it was always too big? Well, it was, okay? If you extrapolate the expansion backwards in time, it was simply always too big. It didn't really begin with a point, but even if it did begin with a point, the distance over which light could have traveled was still smaller. You just have to trust me on that. The equations are rather complex to show that. Now, of course, the universe at those early times when it was hot and dense was opaque, so even light couldn't have traveled the distances that I've been telling you about. It would have just jostled around, all right? But perhaps neutrinos could have traveled that far. Now, when the universe was very dense, even neutrinos couldn't have traveled that far. But that's not the point. Perhaps something could have traveled that far. All I'm saying is that even if you let the signal travel at the speed of light, that signal is not sufficiently fast to have equilibrized the whole universe. Not that we know of any such signal at early times, but all others would have been slower and would have had even less success in bringing the universe to equilibrium. The idea of inflation is that maybe the universe started out much, much smaller than the standard Big Bang says at any given time, so that it could come into equilibrium, and then it inflated by a gargantuan factor and became the size that we now see, or even bigger. So I gave you a numerical example at the end of the last lecture. Let me show it in graphical form. Here is the radius of the observed universe on the vertical axis. This is our observed universe right now. At the present time, it's, you know, some number of meters. All right, way over here, present time, it's 10 to the 27 meters, something like that. And you extrapolate that backwards in time, and you see that the radius of the presently observed universe was smaller in the past. And at time equal, you know, 10 to the minus 50, it was some number. Let's focus on 10 to the minus 37. It was about 0.01 meters in size. That's what I said. All right, so that's how big it was according to the standard Big Bang. But we showed in the graph that I showed previously that light couldn't have traveled that far, so the universe couldn't have come into equilibrium. Suppose instead that at that time, 10 to the minus 37 seconds, the universe was actually much, much smaller, around 10 to the 51 or so, whatever. Doesn't even really matter what the number is, just much, much smaller. Small enough that light or slower signals could have brought it into equilibrium. And then the universe went through an accelerated rate of expansion, doubling in size every tiny fraction of a second, up to an age of something like 10 to the minus 35 seconds. And then whatever this process was that was causing the universe to inflate, it turned off, and at that point, the universe continued along the usual trajectory that the standard Big Bang says. Well, the universe began then so much smaller than the standard theory says that it could have come into equilibrium with itself through the transmission of signals, light or other ones that are much slower. It doesn't matter because it was so small that it was able to do this. All right? Another example might show you. Instead of looking at the observable universe, let's look at the entire universe. Just suppose, for the purposes of example here, that the entire universe had a radius of 10 to the minus 40 meters at t equals 10 to the minus 37 seconds. If it inflated by a factor of 10 to the 100, a Google, by t equals 10 to the minus 35, then the new radius at t equals 10 to the minus 35 is 10 to the 60th meters, 10 to the 60 meters, all right? 10 to the 100 times bigger. Well, the observable universe, or the presently observable universe, at that time had a radius of only 0.1 meter. And, you know, currently the observable universe has a radius of only about 10 to the 27 meters. All those numbers are much smaller than 10 to the 60th, i.e., the universe itself, after inflation, is way bigger than we even need it to be. It's way bigger than anything we can see, and even bigger than the parts of the universe that we can't see. It's big enough to encompass everything and then some. All right? Inflation produces a truly enormous universe. Instead of this one that slowly grows with time, according to the standard Big Bang, you have a tiny little thing that then goes whoosh, grows to an unimaginably large radius, and then the whooshing agent, whatever it is, turns off, and the standard expansion continues. So you get a very flat universe, omega equals 1, because it's such a big ball, for example. It's far bigger than we can see. The stretching of it occurs at such a rate and over such a time that you might be able to stretch it by a factor of 10 to the 1 trillion. I was talking about a Google a minute ago and you know, 10 to the 51 in the previous lecture. But in fact, if you let inflation go on for a reasonable fraction of a second, you can make the actual expansion factor anything you want. And it may sound ad hoc at this point, but I'll justify all this in a minute. So you can make the universe as big as you want if you just let this inflation proceed long enough. I indicated here that the stretching, the expansion, occurs at a speed much, much greater than the speed of light. You might think, well, this surely indicates that what I'm feeding you is a bunch of baloney. How can the universe expand faster than the speed of light? You were taught on your mother's knee that nothing can go faster than the speed of light. But in fact, what relativity says is that no two objects can pass each other faster than the speed of light. Put another way, you can't transmit information through the universe at a speed faster than that of light. You can, however, expand space faster than the speed of light. No information is traveling through space at that speed. You can't tell someone your name at that speed, because the space itself expanding doesn't carry information from one point to another. All right? You can make it expand faster than light even in a non-inflationary scenario. Let me go back to my favorite one-dimensional universe. This one here, if you'll grab hold of that end, I'll grab hold of this one. This is the rubber hose, which is space. And the ping pong balls are the galaxies, or the clusters of galaxies. And we've seen many times now that the universe can stretch, even according to the standard Big Bang. The point is this. If, say, in 1 second, I stretch the hose so that every centimeter becomes 2 centimeters, I just double every centimeter, then if I take two galaxies that are sufficiently far apart from each other, arbitrarily far apart, this is an infinite one-dimensional universe, the stretching of space, 2 centimeters from what used to be 1, multiplied over all of the centimeters that exist between your two objects, lead to a total growth in the size of the universe between those two objects, between those two galaxies, which exceeds the speed of light. Because I could choose these two galaxies to be arbitrarily far apart from each other to begin with. And if every centimeter stretches into 2, then if there are enough centimeters in between those two objects, I will have stretched that many centimeters in 1 second, and that many centimeters can easily exceed 3 times 10 to the 10th, the number of centimeters per second, that is the speed of light. I can have as many centimeters as I want between these two galaxies originally. If I stretch each one, then I've doubled the total size, and I can do that in a very short time interval. So space is stretching at a speed faster than that of light. And you can go, even in a normal universe, to points that are far apart from each other and have them recede from each other faster than the speed of light. In the case of the inflationary expansion, you can have two points that recede from each other so quickly that they effectively go whoosh, and what used to be a centimeter after a split seconds becomes a trillion centimeters, a quadrillion centimeters, any number of centimeters, depending on how you tune your inflationary model. So the space, a tiny, tiny space of the universe, expands faster than the speed of light to a gargantuan size. And that does not violate relativity, because no information has traveled from one point to another through the universe in that amount of time, over that distance. Okay? So that's the idea. Now, to illustrate what this inflation really means, it's an exponential quantity. It's like doubling something every tiny fraction of a second. Let's look at perhaps a more familiar example, a chess board, which has 64 squares. So suppose I place one grain of wheat on the first square. A grain of wheat is only 5 millimeters in size. All right, so I've exaggerated it here. But in the other frames, I won't exaggerate it. And now let's double the number of wheat grains for every successive square that we go on. So the square number 2 will have 2 grains. Square number 4 will have 4 grains. I'm sorry, square number 3 will have 4 grains. Square number 4 will have 8 grains. Square number 5 will have 16. Square number 6 will have 32, and so on. At first, that doubling doesn't sound like it's doing much. But look what's going to happen to all those grains of wheat. By the 10th square, you have 2 to the 9th power of wheat grains. That may look like a thumbtack, a big thumbtack. By square 19, you have a pile of wheat grains the diameter or the length of a pencil. By square number 28, you have a pile of wheat grains about the size of a person. They're starting to grow pretty fast. By square number 37, you have a pile of wheat grains the size of a bus. By square 46, you have the pile of wheat grains the size of a 10-story building. And by 55, you have a pile of wheat grains the size of the Empire State Building. By the final square of your chessboard, that pile of wheat grains covers most of Manhattan. Here it is, sticking out a little bit. This is the beginnings of a disaster movie that I have in my mind. Okay, the pile of wheat grains. 64 doublings is all that took. 64 doublings. Try folding a sheet of paper. It's hard to do more than 7 or 8 times. It grows in thickness too quickly. You're exponentially increasing the size of something, the number of grains, and that function grows very, very quickly until it becomes unhandleable, essentially. So that's the idea behind inflation. The universe goes quickly. All right, well, that sounds ad hoc. But do we have any reason for believing that inflation really did begin? I mean, it's all fine and dandy to say, all right, if the universe expanded exponentially for 10 to the minus 35 seconds, then we can have any size we want. But hey, okay, is there any reason at all that we should suspect that the universe might do such an outlandish thing? Why should it do that? Well, to answer this, let's look at GUTS, grand unified theories, the guts of the matter. For a long time, it was thought that there were 4 fundamental forces in nature. There was gravity, which is extremely weak, but affects all of matter, and so we feel it as a long-range force. There's electromagnetism, which for a given distance is 10 to the 39 times stronger than gravity. For example, the electromagnetic or the electric force between a proton and an electron in a hydrogen atom is 10 to the 39 times stronger than the gravitational force between a proton and an electron. It acts, however, only on charged particles, and since most objects in the universe are neutral, we don't feel the electromagnetic forces over long ranges. We do feel them in our bodies. We're not aware of them, typically. I don't sit around worrying about them. But that's what holds the atoms and molecules in our bodies together. It's electromagnetic forces. All right. Then there's the strong nuclear force, which is about 100 times stronger than the electromagnetic force. But it has an extremely short range. It acts only over the distances of nuclei or actually subatomic particles, subnuclear particles, protons and neutrons. And to be strictly speaking correct, the strong nuclear force is sort of an afterglow of an even more fundamental and stronger force called the color force. It's the force that holds the quarks together in a proton or a neutron. The residual, the strong nuclear force, which holds, say, a proton and a neutron together in a nucleus, that's just what's left over outside of the proton and the neutron. The color force is the more fundamental thing, and it's even stronger. But for historical reasons and for simplicity, I'll continue to call it the strong force. And then there's the weak nuclear force, or simply the weak force, which is about a millionth as strong as the electromagnetic force. It too, like the strong force, has a very short range, and it dictates the decay of neutrons into protons, electrons, and antineutrinos. In a sense, what holds those three particles together to constitute a neutron is the weak nuclear force. Very short range, very strange force, but in fact quite critical, because it's the strength of that force that dictates how slowly stars burn up their nuclear fuel. And if that force were a different strength, stars might burn out very quickly. And that whole subject of how finely tuned the universe is will be a topic of my last lecture. It almost looks like it's tuned for the existence of life. Well, it is now thought, in fact, more than thought, it's pretty much been proven, that the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force are unified. They are different manifestations of the same fundamental force, the so-called electroweak force. They are just different aspects of it. This unification was done a few decades ago. It's similar to the unification that James Clerk Maxwell achieved when he showed that the electric and magnetic forces are different manifestations of the same thing, the electromagnetic force. We don't even think of them as different anymore. I mean, they have different manifestations. A charge produces certain field lines. Magnetism produces other field lines. But you can transform one into the other depending on your reference frame and if you move electric fields and so on. They're the same fundamental interaction. So in the same way, there is now the electroweak force, which substitutes for the previous weak and electromagnetic forces. And so fundamentally, there are three forces now known. But in real low-energy life, in the low-energy universe, we do see four apparently different forces. The weak force does look different from the electromagnetic force. It's just that at high energies, when the temperature of the universe used to be gargantuan, the electromagnetic force and the weak force looked exactly the same. All right? There was no difference between them in the early universe when the temperatures were high, or in giant accelerators on Earth where you really bash particles together hard. Then you see that the electromagnetic force and the weak force behave in the same way. All right? Okay, well, let us consider now grand unified theories. Grand unified theories attempt to go one step farther than just the electroweak theory. They attempt to unify the electroweak force and the strong nuclear force into one. Okay, that's what the grand unified theories attempt to do. And we expect from an extrapolation of what we know that the temperatures needed to truly unify these things, that is, the temperature at which the forces become indistinguishable, that's around 10 to the 28 or 10 to the 29 kelvins, unimaginably large. However, the universe achieved such temperatures at an age of around 10 to the minus 37, 10 to the minus 35 seconds. The universe is that great big accelerator in the sky. We're never going to make accelerators on Earth that achieve anywhere close to those sorts of energies. So fundamental particle physicists have to turn to astronomers, to cosmologists, in order to test some of their fundamental theories of nature, because the universe did achieve such energies. Grand unified theories predict that protons should decay. There are many different grand unified theories. We don't know which one is correct yet. They predict different decay timescales for the protons. Some predicted a decay timescale of 10 to the 30th years. Well, the current experimental limit is at least 10 to the 31 years and is inching close to 10 to the 32 these days. So already some grand unified theories have been ruled out. There are many of them. But we don't yet know which of the remaining ones, if any, is the correct one. Those giant underground tanks of water that detected the neutrinos from supernova 1987A were built basically to test this, not to find neutrinos from a supernova. They are the experiments which have led to these lower limits on the lifetime of a proton. So if and when they find the lifetime of a proton, certain classes of grand unified theories will be thrown out, and only the ones that have that predicted time will remain. So far, the only real test of grand unified theories, since we haven't measured the decay of a proton yet, is simply that there is an observed excess of matter over antimatter. That is a consequence of the grand unified theories. That should have been the case if they are correct. However, that's not an extremely restrictive measurement right now. It's just an excess. And the different grand unified theories don't really say precisely what that excess should be in magnitude. Well, you might say, is this it? Are grand unified theories the final theory? No, because they do not yet include gravity. If you believe that all the forces are unified at some enormously high temperature, so that they all look fundamentally the same when particles are bashing into each other really hard, then you would have to go a step further than the grand unified theories. And those are the so-called TOEs, or theories of everything. They attempt to unify the grand unified theory force and gravity. And some plausible ideas have been thought about, these superstring theories. I'll have a little bit more to say about them later. They are only an attempt. Modifications are being made even as I speak. We don't know whether they're close to being the truth. They predict some weird things like shadow matter, matter that exerts a gravitational force but cannot be directly detected through electromagnetic radiation. That would be a candidate for dark matter if it's true. Okay? But basically what physicists would like is a unification of the type that Maxwell had, but for all the forces. We want there to be one super force, a grand unified, well, more than a grand unified force, a super unified force. Let me paraphrase Tolkien. One force to rule them all. One force to find them. One force to bring them all and in the darkness bind them. That's what physicists want. One force, not one ring. Okay, well, so we have this super unified force sometime long ago in the past. And the most rudimentary theories suggest that at the Planck time, which is the fundamental quantum unit of time below which we're not even sure what time means, gravity would have broken off and become a different manifestation of that super unified force, leaving the grand unified force to continue on. And then at some slightly later time, 10 to the minus 37 seconds, the strong force will have broken off and become a different manifestation, leaving the electroweak force. And then somewhat later at t equals 10 to the minus 12 seconds, the electroweak force will have broken down into the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force. This is similar to a spinning quarter. Suppose I take a quarter, a coin, and I flick it along a tabletop. It's spinning quickly, initially. It's symmetric. I look at it from either direction, any direction. It looks the same. I don't know that it's got a heads or a tails. It's just spinning. The coin looks like just a spinning blob. As it decreases its spin rate due to friction on the table, it will eventually slow down and finally fall over to either heads or tails. The symmetric coin, the amalgam of two forces, two faces in this case, will have flipped over either to a heads or to a tails. Those are akin to the two forces that break off when a more unified force goes down to a low enough temperature where the symmetry is broken. Okay? So you initially can't tell that there's a heads and a tails, but in the low energy world, you can tell because the symmetry gets broken. The spherical shape of the spinning coin gets broken. So this is what we expect. We expect these sorts of phase transitions, as they're called, to occur. These phase transitions are like water freezing. if I have water above 0 degrees Celsius, and then I slowly lower its temperature, generally, when I reach 0 degrees Celsius, the water will begin to freeze, and it'll turn into ice crystals. And you might think that ice crystals are a more symmetric form of water, but in the context that we're discussing here, that's considered a less symmetric form of water. A blob of water out in space, in the vacuum, would be a sphere. You could observe it from any direction, and it would look the same. There's no preferred axis. If that droplet were to freeze, then there would be some hexagonal structure, and there would be certain axes where the crystal looked different than along other axes. That would be a less symmetrical situation in the way in which I'm describing it here, in the way that physicists describe symmetry. So, water goes from a symmetric liquid form with no preferred axis to ice at a low enough temperature. It does this by releasing energy, the energy which kept its molecules in motion, and that energy, upon release, allows the ice crystals to form to break the symmetry of the spherical blob of water. However, we know that in certain cases, water can be supercooled. We can cool water down to a temperature below 0 degrees Celsius. And if we don't agitate it, if we don't disturb it, the water can achieve a temperature lower than zero, yet remain in the liquid state. This is called supercooling. Clouds of gas often do this. They're supercooled gas. Then you seed them a little bit, you tickle them a little bit, and they turn into water or ice, all right? They undergo the phase transition, which they should have gone through, had all been normal, at a higher temperature. But for some reason, they cooled down in a static, quiescent way, and they were able to retain that extra energy that keeps the molecules in motion, yet still have, classically, kinetically, a lower temperature. Supercooled matter has an energy content greater than would have been anticipated given its temperature. If you then cool supercooled water and then finally agitate it, releasing the energy, it will rapidly transform into crystals and it will release that heat, that energy. Let me give you an example of this. I have here a substance called the heat solution. You can buy it in camping stores, and it's just a mushy, clear solution of sodium acetate, water, and some other stuff. It feels pretty cool. It's at room temperature. But I claim it's a supercooled solution. If I now agitate it a little bit, let me agitate a little metal disc that's in there. I'll bend it. Hard to bend. Get going. There we go. You can see that it begins to change color. The change in color is due to the fact that it's crystallizing. It's changing from a liquid to a solid. There it goes. It's almost completed its transformation now, its phase transition. And now if I hold it, youch! I really can't hold it in my hand very long because it's really quite hot. And I'm not just fooling you. I could toss it to you, but I won't. It's very hot. It's latent heat, the heat of that was in the liquid, has been released upon the phase transition, and now it is heating up the whole thing, heating up my hands, releasing all the heat that used to be within all those molecules, keeping them in a liquid state. So a huge amount of energy was stored in this supercooled solution. You can get this to keep yourself warm at night on camping trips. It's amazing stuff. But it is a super cooled solution. And the energy, the extra energy, is released upon undergoing this phase transition. Now, suppose the universe went through a super cooled state where instead of the grand unified force breaking into the strong nuclear force and electroweak force, it instead remained grand and unified, even at temperatures below 10 to the 29 degrees Kelvin. So it didn't break symmetry. It was super cooled in this sense. It was still in a phase that preceded this low temperature. It was the phase that was characteristic of the higher temperature. The universe at this stage had too much energy for its physical state. It's like water at a temperature below 0 degrees, or like my heat solution at room temperature. It should be a solid, but it's not. The analogy here breaks down a little bit. Water, or my supercooled heat solution, just sort of sit there. Even though they have extra energy, they don't do much. They just sort of sit there. The molecules move around. In the case of the universe, however, the vacuum, which contained all this extra energy associated with the grand unified force, it caused, or the vacuum itself expanded exponentially due to the pressure exerted by this extra energy that it contained. There the analogy breaks down. It's a good thing, too. You wouldn't want a glass of water that you stuck in your freezer to supercool and then inflate to such a size that it rams your whole house into the heavens or destroys your whole house. So the analogy breaks down. This energy of the false vacuum in the case of a supercooled grand unified force would have an effect where it inflates the universe. This is reminiscent of what we think we've found in observing the distant supernovae. We think the universe right now is accelerating in its expansion, but ever so slightly compared with the effect I'm talking about. This effect would cause a doubling in the size of the universe every tiny fraction of a second, like every 10 to the minus 38 seconds or 10 to the 37 seconds, it would double in size. So that by the time you reach 10 to the minus 35 seconds, 100 or 1,000 or more doublings will have occurred, and a little tiny thing will have inflated into a gigantic volume. Eventually, something will tickle the universe. Quantum fluctuations will tickle the universe, for example, and the phase transition will have occurred. Too late. Not too late for us, because it inflated the universe, which is good. That's like the phase transition of water to ice, or the phase transition that I just illustrated in the supercooled heat solution. The symmetry at that point was broken. The energy stored in that vacuum field, the false vacuum, was released. And from all that energy, matter and antimatter formed. All those high-energy photons then made matter and antimatter, both of which, I remind you, have positive energy. When matter and antimatter meet, they produce photons. If you have lots of high-energy photons, they can produce matter and antimatter. So it is from this energy of the so-called false vacuum, whatever that means, and I can't go into detail, in part because I don't understand myself, to tell you the truth. But whatever this stuff is, it is what inflated the universe. All right? The predictions of inflation are numerous. Here I give a partial list of at least the ones I discussed already and a few others. The homogeneity and isotropy problem is solved, again, because the universe was much smaller in the past and was able to come into equilibrium, and then this force blew it apart, this anti-gravity, if you will, the energy of the false vacuum. The second prediction was the flatness, the fact that the observed spatial geometry of the universe appears to be flat. That's the same thing as saying that the matter content plus this cosmological constant is one. Well, even if you don't believe the supernova results, you say, to hell with this cosmological constant. There's some sort of dust dimming those supernovae or whatever. Well, the matter content of the universe is still pretty close to one and demands something that drives it close to one. Theorists really do want the thing to be one, and I kind of doubt that there's enough dark matter alone to make omega equal to one. So I think this is yet another indication that our supernova observations are correct, because we suggest that there's another contribution to omega, and that's the cosmological constant contribution. And lo and behold, when we measure its size, it's 0.76, and we think omega matter is 0.24, so the total ends up being unity. So we think it all works out just great. But even if you don't believe the cosmological constant, omega is already close enough to unity that it pretty much demands that there be some physical mechanism, rather than just someone saying, let it be so, at the beginning. So we explain the flatness. There's few, if any, magnetic monopoles in the universe. These are like the north or south pole of a magnet, sitting there all alone. We know of no such magnets. You take a normal magnet, north and south pole, break it in half, you get two smaller magnets, each with a north pole and a south pole. There are no north poles sitting around all alone, and there are no south poles. Why not? Fundamental theories suggest there should be many of them, and that they should be very massive, and we should know about them. We don't know about them. They're not there. Where are they? Inflation inflated them away to regions far, far away from us in the universe. Maybe there's one within our observable universe. Maybe there are two. Maybe there's zero. Inflation took whatever population of monopoles there was in the past and spread them out too thinly for us to observe. And then there's the distribution of matter over various size scales. What is it that dictates the size scales over which clusters of galaxies occur, and the amplitude of the matter fluctuation which caused the cluster of galaxies? What about the superclusters? What about the galaxies themselves? The universe is filled with structure having different amplitudes, that is, different sort of size scales and mass scales. Inflation seems to predict a spectrum of distributions of sizes and masses, which is remarkably like what we observe in our universe. So that's a prediction of inflation that seems to be borne out by observations. And there are others as well. The key point is that in the inflationary scenario, the universe is way, way bigger than we can see. It's not just that the universe is vast and we see the Hubble Deep Field full of so many galaxies that extrapolated over the whole sky, it's maybe 100 billion. Hey, you ain't seen nothing yet. There are such vast spaces beyond what we can see that they dwarf the 100 billion galaxies to which our telescopes have access. And these are beyond the microwave background. They're beyond anything that we can see because the true universe is much, much bigger than the little part that we observe. Just as for a long time, people staying at home and who did not travel very far would have no real reason, based on their own experience, to believe that the Earth is much bigger than their local neighborhood. Okay? Well, we can't test directly whether the universe is as humongous as inflation claims, but we can test the other predictions of inflation. They seem to be in line with what we observe. The total energy of the universe, after having gone through inflation, is about zero, it turns out. Inflation has the curious property that it doesn't really increase the total energy or mass content of the universe. It produces all these particles and stuff which came out of the energy of the false vacuum once the phase transition occurred. Sure, matter and antimatter were created. We were created. We're sitting around here discussing these amazing thoughts. But there's a negative component as well, and that's the gravitational force, the gravitational energy, in a sense, of the universe. Every object exerts a gravitational force on every other object. And when you sum up all those gravitational forces, the associated energy is equal to, but the negative of, the energy associated with matter, photons, and everything else. An example is this ball. If I have it at rest here, I can define its energy to be zero. If I now drop it, it clearly picks up speed. It picks up kinetic energy. Where did that energy come from? Did I get something from nothing? Am I going to be rich and famous because I've invented a perpetual motion machine? No. All I've done is I've dropped the ball. And its energy of motion comes at the expense of a greater but more negative gravitational energy. So that the new gravitational energy, when it's down here in its trajectory, plus the kinetic energy, is still equal to zero, the energy which it had to begin with. So in a similar way, all the matter and photons and everything else created in the universe, they are positive energy, but they exert a gravitational force on each other whose associated energy is equal to and opposite the energy of the matter, the antimatter, and the photons. So the sum of those two is about zero, should be identically zero, okay? That's a natural consequence of inflation. The reason I say that the energy will be about zero, not identically equal to zero, is that you needed something to start this whole process. You needed there to be a little bit of matter and antimatter and other junk, some sort of stuff, all sort of jostling around, in which the inflation could have taken over. You needed the universe to have lived for 10 to the minus 30 seconds, or perhaps only 10 to the minus 43 seconds if this inflation occurred when gravity broke off rather than when the strong nuclear force broke off. You know, whenever there's a broken symmetry like this, you might have an inflationary state. So all we needed was a little bit of the universe to have somehow come into existence, entered an inflationary state, and then inflation would take over and produce all the rest. Well, how do you get that little bit? How do you do it? Quantum mechanics may tell us the answer. The ultimate question, what produced the energy before inflation? It may have been a quantum fluctuation out of nothing at all. Now, I don't exactly know what I mean by nothing. To gain a better understanding of everything, physicists will have to gain a better understanding of what they mean by nothing. Do I mean nothing as in a vacuum in this universe, or nothing in a pre-existing space from which our universe was born? Well, I probably mean the latter, but if there was a pre-existing space, what does that mean? Was that a super universe, a meta universe? This is where things are a bit fuzzy. And indeed, this is quite speculative, let me be quite honest here. But we know that quantum fluctuations are occurring in the universe right now. I've mentioned before that quantum fluctuations, the production of electron-positron pairs for brief instants of time, actually affects the energy levels of the hydrogen atom and other atoms. But the hydrogen atom has been measured with great precision, and it is shown that the measured energy levels would differ from the predicted energy levels if we did not take into account the quantum fluctuations. So they do occur. Let a quantum fluctuation occur. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle says that if you let it occur for a sufficiently short time, and if it's a sufficiently small amount of energy that you're talking about, such that the product of those two is less than Planck's constant, or Planck's constant divided by 2 pi, then in a sense, these particles are virtual. They're not real. They will destroy themselves under ordinary circumstances in a split second, some amount of time, delta t. So these are virtual particles. In a sense, the universe doesn't notice, but in another sense, it does notice, because I just said that it affects the energy levels of the hydrogen atom. The universe most certainly does notice, but it doesn't notice in the sense that it says, hey, stop it. That's a violation of the law of conservation of mass and energy. At the quantum level, that law can be violated. So you can see what this is leading up to. Let whatever was out there, I don't want to call it the universe, the meta-universe, the super-universe, I don't know what it's called. Let's call it Fred, in honor of Fred Hoyle. Whatever was out there, let the laws of physics have been created such that a quantum fluctuation could have occurred, and let it live long enough such that inflation takes over. Now, most quantum fluctuations might not live long enough, but if there are lots of them going on, here and there and everywhere, then some of them might live long enough. According to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, the ones that live a long time, relatively speaking, are the ones that have the smallest amount of energy. So if you create the Empire State Building and an anti-Empire State Building, you're not going to be able to do it for very long. But a proton anti-proton you can do for longer. An electron anti-electron you can do for even longer. Let at least one of those quantum fluctuations live sufficiently long that the phase transition that should have occurred doesn't occur. The thing becomes kind of supercooled in a sense, although there are now other ways of thinking about it that are more general. So I'll just say, let inflation take over, and then it does the rest for us, for the universe. It expands this little tiny ball that was created as a result of a quantum fluctuation, makes it into a gargantuan universe, and the energy of that universe in total is basically zero. All you started with was this tiny little bit of energy that came from this uncertainty principle, quantum physics' way of violating the rule of conservation of mass energy. But then you inflate the universe into a gargantuan thing, and later, who knows, the particle, antiparticle could find themselves and annihilate. So in the end, the total energy becomes identically zero. Who knows? Doesn't really matter. You just have a little quantum violation of the conservation of mass energy, and that then gives birth to the whole universe. We don't know yet whether this is correct, but this seems to be the current Best Buy theory for how it is that our universe came into existence. Whether the laws of physics were born with it or before it, we don't know. But it came to be, perhaps, as a result of a quantum fluctuation out of nothing. And as such, it can be called the ultimate free lunch.